Welcome to New Books in Political Science. My name is Heath Brown. Today I have the real pleasure to speak with Cindy E-Sen Chang. Cindy, how are you doing?
I'm well, thank you.
Good, good. It was such a pleasure to read your book, Citizens of Asian America, Democracy and Race During the Cold War. Before we get to this big book, big in details, maybe we can learn a little bit more about you, what your background is, where you are now, and what sort of put you in place to write this book.
Well, I'm currently an associate professor of history and Asian American studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I think I came, to my topic. It was really just one of those things where in grad school, my very first quarter at UC, University of California, Irvine, I took a course called, Cold War Culture with Professor John Wiener, who then became my advisor. And I was just so fascinated with the period. I fell in love with it. And it was, at the time when I started grad school, there was, it was actually shocking how there was almost nothing on Asian Americans, post in that, period between after World War II and before 1965, and which is when, the Immigration Act passed and a whole new wave of Asian immigrants came into the United States. There's so little on that period. And so when I had to write the paper on Asian Americans during that period, I had so little to go by, and it just stuck because I started to I just started very basic. I just had to weave through countless of newspapers to find anything, to kind of see what was going on. And that's kind of how I came across this project. It was very much just a product of a class.
Your methods are so very interesting, and maybe we can talk about them as you go, because you're telling very detailed stories and from a time period that sort of feels like it's so long in the past. But you were able to interview some of the very people that you are focused on in the book. Isn't that right?
Yeah, I think this is something that I learned ever since I was an undergraduate student at UCLA, which is that a lot of times when you do certain kinds of ethnic history, especially when it's, let's say, Latino or Asian Americans, there's not going to be this archive that you go to, where you can go and look through a depository of materials that were saved. There are some, but it's not quite as common as other kinds of historical topics. And so one of the one of the methods that really benefited the field of ethnic studies is oral history, is to realize that everyday people, because a lot of the early Asian immigrants are pretty humble. They're your farmers. They're your factory workers. Their lives are not going to be recorded in important international affairs, and you start to realize that people's family histories, their parents and their journeys to the United States should be considered historically relevant. And one of the movements it has been to interview people to get their stories and to realize that they're shaping history. And so when I began looking into this, because there wasn't an archive that I could just go to go into this, I started to track down, a lot of people have passed away since then, but when I was in grad school, I was able to track down a number of second generation Chinese Americans who lived in the Los Angeles area. And I did that by, I just went and started to volunteer at different kinds of Chinese American organizations. Met people, and through snowball sampling, I was able to kind of come across, all these people, and I just wanted to talk about their lives, their stories. They're very fairly open-ended interviews, and from there, I tried to establish some level of archive, of the people who lived during that period of time, And so much of this story is, it's actually, a study of history and memory, right, because it's about how they chose to project what they went through.
Okay. So you start the story of Tommy Amer. You start the book with the story of this individual, Tommy Amer.
Mm-hmm.
So who was Tommy Amer, and what is his significance to the story that you try to tell in your book?
Yes. Thank you. Yes. Well, Tommy Amer was somebody that I ended up interviewing, and in the course of my interview with him, he started to talk about how... And it was just a typical interview. He started to talk about how he was involved in the Supreme Court case that made race-based restrictions in housing unconstitutional. And I was completely floored. And I had, you know, in fact, in some ways, I was very curious, like, is that possible? Because there's no way, I never even heard that was, you know, that a Chinese American was involved.
And, right. And give us a sense of the time period. What year are we talking about in terms of the Supreme Court case?
Right.
And when were the sort of, when was his issue prominent?
Very, thank you. Yes, well, this is during the, this is kind of an issue that occurred during the, immediately right after World War II. And during this time, there was a lot of housing shortages, and there was a lot of contentions over nationally over race-based restrictions in housing, which were technically or legally called racial restrictive covenants, where certain kinds of agreements were signed by different parties involved to say that, you know, a particular property or a particular area were not going to be sold or rented to non-whites. And so this is a kind of a common practice. So one of the things I often ask the people I talk to was whether they experienced race-based discrimination in housing, especially those who lived, you know, during the World War II and right after World War II period. And so when I came across this, you know, this became one of the typical, you know, leading questions that I started to ask people that I spoke with. And when Tommy Amer started to share his story, because he was kind of, before all this, he was kind of a celebrated photographer in the war. And so there's quite a newspaper articles about him. And then he started to talk to me about how he was involved in this major Supreme Court case, which the actual landmark Supreme Court case is called Shelley versus Kramer, and that took place in 1947. The significance of that Supreme Court case is that it became the first post-war civil rights, you know, landmark civil rights case. And that was against race-based restrictions in housing.
Right. And how did these covenants actually work? Because, you know, we're led to believe that segregation and white flight from cities to the suburbs were sort of simply a function of choice. And, you know, and that freedom of that choice to flee certain areas and to form segregated neighborhoods might have been racist, but it was just free choice. You suggest that really that's not the case, that there are deep institutional dimensions to white flight.
Exactly.
That don't make it just sort of people making free and individual decisions, that these are concerted, organized. In what ways? How do you make that case?
Well, I think thank you so much for that question. I mean, that's exactly a huge, thing that I wanted to bring to the floor, which is that white flight is a structural, institutionalized practice, in that when new development lands were being built, and I'm looking at this, you know, in this particular chapter, specifically at Los Angeles, what they started to do with developers, before they develop a land, they started to just block, you know, wholesale block a whole lot of land that they were going to build homes on. And instead of having these title deeds written, you know, for every house, they would have a whole block of land, and the deed would say it was whites only. And so the whole phenomenon of white flight is structural, in that only white people could actually go and move to the suburbs of Los Angeles. Only white people could, you know, if they wanted better housing, if they wanted to live in a different area, they were the only ones that were allowed to move. And when you look at the kind of demographics in Los Angeles, it meant that because of these race-based restrictions in housing, that people of color, right, invariably were landlocked or basically, you know, hemmed in to certain portions of Los Angeles, either because they were able to break certain restrictive covenants. There's different methods that I talk about how they went about doing that, or that they were able to purchase houses that were not, you know, did not have these deeds written in the title deeds of certain houses and properties. So for me, you know, when I studied the process of white flight, it's a very structural thing. It's not so much a voluntary thing. It was voluntary in that only a certain segment of the population had the privilege and the right to do so.
Right. And what did the Supreme Court have to say about this? Because you would say, sort of a novice Supreme Court viewer would say, well, this is clearly a violation of the 14th Amendment. What did the Supreme Court during this time period say about these racially restrictive covenants?
Yeah, well, I think for a long time standing, and I kind of obviously through the book I documented very clearly, but for a long time standing, the Supreme Court ruled on the side of saying that these were personal agreements between people and that they were not, and because they were personal, they should not, the state should not be intervening in these kinds of contracts, and that these were not public policy but individual agreements. And that is a, you know, and there's been different judges who've dissented from that, these positions, and saying that these are very narrow interpretations of the 14th Amendment. However, for, you know, one of the major Supreme Court cases that came out of Washington, D.C. was saying that not only was D.C. not, you know, within technically within federal jurisdiction, but that these title deeds were a personal agreement. And from them, from that point on, racially restrictive covenants completely proliferated. It became a sanction to allow, because it made it seem like it was a personal agreement between two people as opposed to a state legislated policy. But there's nothing personal about these agreements, and there's nothing that was not state instituted. Right. And in fact, if you, people, you know, often study the case in New York Levittown, which to receive, you know, when they built the Federal Housing Authority to receive actual, you know, aid from the federal government to build certain kinds of housing, they had to have this whites-only restriction in the deed to even to obtain federal, you know, compensation. So this was definitely a state-instituted thing. But I think
this is not just directed at African Americans. One of the key contributions of your book
yeah.
is draw attention to this is not a white-black issue alone.
Thank
this
you.
Is a
yeah.
white versus just about everyone else. So how did Asian Americans fit into this story that you know, we would say, okay, well, this makes sense. That's what I would anticipate for African Americans. But Asian Americans face some of these same restrictive policies.
Right. Actually, what I wanted to bring to the fore is that I think a lot of times when we study U.S. history, regions and time periods are very important to look at. And when you look at the West Coast and you look at, you know, different states, like California in particular, you start to realize that the first legislations against racial segregation was going to be against Chinese immigrants as opposed to African Americans. And that when people looked at urban housing restrictions, the first court case was not going to be involving an African American. It was going to be involving Chinese immigrants. So when you study urban housing restrictions, the group that kind of you know, began this kind of legal precedent for race-based restrictions in housing in these areas became, the case study became, you know, Asian immigrants and Chinese immigrants in particular. And
right.
I think that's where, when you do study something like Asian Americans, you really complicate that, you know, white-black divide. And that when you look at different areas and different parts of history that, the main group targeted is going to be very different. So Chinese immigrants actually shaped the legislation of race-based restrictions in housing for nationally speaking. They were the cases that all legal cases built a precedent on. And
yeah.
the thing changed in California, as I remarked, following World War I, towards World War II, in that there was going to be a huge influx of African Americans into Los Angeles, into the California area. So the same laws and practices that were developed to maintain you know, whites away from Asian immigrants became applied and interpreted to blacks in, you know, in California, Los Angeles in particular. So when you do that history, you start to see that the main targets of these restrictions were actually Asian immigrants prior to African Americans, but that African Americans, you know, later on as they started to move more and more. And this has to do with the fact that not that Asian immigrants no longer became a threat. We have to realize that after 1924, the United States basically curtailed new Asian immigration to the United States so that the population diminished significantly, so that the most visible racialized group in Los Angeles during that time were blacks. And so, you know, that's kind of the legal end of that. And
right.
So,
and
yeah.
But things change. Your book is about the Cold War, and,
yeah.
and that's sort of the complicated double story that you tell. coming out of World War II, you describe the national reflection on the internment of Japanese Americans,
mm-hmm.
and perceptions that the world is starting to, particularly the Soviet world, mm-hmm. is starting to see the discrimination that is widespread in the United States. What is the reaction during the Cold War of national policymakers, the president, the people around the president, to the situation that you describe prior to the Cold War? What changes?
Exactly. I think one of the key things that we start to see is that the credibility, legitimacy of American democracy became international policy, and that for the United States to kind of maintain some kind of legitimacy in international policy, they had to kind of promote that their democracy was real. And that Soviet, on the other hand, Soviet, at the terms will switch between totalitarianism to communism, was in fact the corrupt force, right? And that democracy was the one that was really going to generate greater freedoms over communism. And so the biggest shift from, post-World War II to the Cold War was when the United States wanted to, claim to be the major, superpower of the world, it needed to establish the credibility of democracy. And the Soviet propaganda machine was basically every story against racism, lynchings of blacks in the South, they would publicize it to kind of say, would you want to join forces with the United States, given the fact that the history of the United States, it's been so detrimental to different countries and to different groups of people. And this was also, in terms of Asian Americans, this was also a carryover in World War II, in that for the United States to have China as an ally during World War II, one of the biggest sticking points was the Chinese Exclusion Act that first got instituted in 1882. And in 1943, during World War II, there was a special, session called, and that the Chinese Exclusion Acts were repealed because Japanese propaganda was saying, China, why would you side with the United States? They don't want you into their country. They don't accept you as citizens. They have a history of anti-Chinese sentiment. Why would you join forces with them? And so the United States has always internationally had to kind of think through, their racist policies as a way to maintain some kind of international credibility and to maintain some international relations. And so the Cold War became kind of an extension, towards that, to kind of really going out on this campaign to say that there's no place in the United States for racism, because how do we, sell democracy abroad if we can't practice that at home, became this very popular saying, right?
Right. And so in what ways, and we can get to some of the other side of the story, but but in what ways would life have gotten better for Asian Americans, either in housing policy or in other ways? What were the tangible things that were done during this time period to project, at least, the reality is different, but at least to project this image through policies that the United States was not deeply segregated, was not deeply discriminatory, was not what the Soviets were propagandizing in the world?
Exactly. Yeah. The ones I look at, I obviously look at immigration policies and I look at housing policies. So the foremost thing is to think about housing desegregation and allowing the federal government, an unprecedented move, became a friend of the Supreme Court and submitted a petition to support the unconstitutional ruling of race-based restrictions in housing. And so I think in terms of, promoting that, to going against race-based restrictions in housing was one thing I look at, but I also look at immigration policies, in that not only were, in 1952, the federal government extended the right to citizenship to now all Asian groups. In 1943, the right to become a naturalized citizens were only extended to Chinese immigrants. By 1952, the right to naturalized citizenship became extended to all Asian groups. And then from that point on, you start to see, and finally in 1965, right, the racial quotas that were established in immigration policies for the first time became abolished, that there was not a necessarily racial quota, but a national quota. And right. so I think in terms of, you know, Asian immigrants, their understanding of civil rights really started to come to the fore with immigration reform, right?
Yeah, and things were, in some ways, if we just sort of crudely characterize it, tolerance was expanding. Mm-hmm. There were some policy changes that signaled an end to some of the segregation policies that existed.
Mm-hmm.
But the Cold War had this secondary effect
yeah.
on certain communities
yeah.
and certain community organizations.
Yeah.
I wonder if you could recount the story of David Hyun and Diamond Kim.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, that was
why they added to what we added and made this story both more complicated and so much more interesting is the way you tell it.
Thank you. Yes, I kind of hit upon the dual dimensions of Cold War democracy, which was not only the fact that the United States has to pass different legislation to use, you know, racial equality as a way to establish the credibility of U.S. democracy, but also I looked at the fact that having to suppress communist forces to kind of make sure to, you know, to scrutinize the political activities of leftists and progressives and radicals in the United States became, you know, we all know that communist dating, you know, all that during the Cold War, that's another reigning theme, was a big thing. The McCarthyism, you know, was a huge thing of the Cold War to kind of weave those stories together. That this is a time when we saw different, you know, rights extended to racialized minorities, but we saw the deep infringement of civil liberties in terms of political activities. And so what I try to do with that is to look at how, when you look at Asian Americans, they actually prominently figured on both sides of that coin. On one, they were racialized minorities, were extending, you know, the right to live where they wanted to live, show that the United States democracy was valid. But on the other hand, given the fact that in 1949, the Chinese government became communist, right, and that the outbreak of the Korean War left Korea divided between North and South Korea, right, that there was a split and that there was a group that became, the North became communist, that the United States also needed to monitor the political activities, right, of Chinese and Koreans more stringently to see if they were, you know, subversive forces and, you know. And so I think I looked at that, too, to kind of look at how, the credibility, the legitimacy of the American political system was also contingent. It was also dependent on the suppression of, you know, radical forces, those who really thought that communism or leftist politics or communism as an ideology was perhaps had something to offer to the concept of democracy. And so the story of David Hyun and Diamond Kim, what I looked at were these two amazing figures. They were definitely, you know, progressives, if not radicals of their time, who much of their careers and much of their lives was really spent in for David Hyun, he began his early childhood living in Kauai in Hawaii and really joining unions to fight for pay equity between whites and racialized laborers on the plantations. He really started to look at the issue of redistribution of wealth. And because he was also of Korean descent, right, he later became like targeted as somebody who was a subversive. Every activity that he became something that the government had to suppress as, you know, as part of its McCarthyism campaign. And Diamond Kim was the same way. He wanted to show that the reign of Syngman Rhee of South Korea, they were not democratic, the side that the United States supported. He wanted to show that perhaps, you know, to have a free Korea, they needed to redistribute wealth away from the aristocrats, away from the elite. They wanted a chance to have national sovereignty. But at that time, that was kind of blasphemy to kind of support, you know, the North side or their ideological positions. And so he also became another target. And the United States, they are just two case studies, but launched an aggressive campaign to deport immigrants who did not, who kind of engaged in political activities that somehow tried to undermine the credibility of American democracy. And that became an important part of, you know, the story of the Cold War.
Yeah, as a way to sort of wrap up and wrap things up a little bit, what is the legacy of this time period for the Asian American community and Asian American politics? What are there things, aspects of this that stuck with the various community groups, and communities throughout the country. This persecution during the Cold War, the targeting of organizations, has this had any lasting effect on Asian American political identity or the banding together of Asian Americans in common cause? What is the lasting effect of this time period?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think I'm not going to be able to say that there's going to be some sense of identifiable or unified, you know, lasting effect, just because with different groups and different immigration periods, people have different kinds of interests. But I do know that one of the lasting impact is that we understand that political relations between the U.S. and Asia has a longstanding effect on the social positions of Asians in the United States. And this kind of impact will have different kinds of intensity with different, you know, throughout different contexts and different times. And one of the things to understand is that, you know, with situations, right, with the situations between U.S. and China, as we're starting to see right now, right, with the economic competition taking a downturn, the kinds of scrutiny and the kinds of anti-China bashing is becoming much more permitted, right? And it's much more common, and it's not going to be scoffed upon, right? And you're going to start to understand if does that in, going to impact Chinese Americans in the United States, right? And I think these become some of the lasting things, is that when we talk about acceptance, we talk about assimilation, these are highly, they're highly kind of loaded understanding, in that the groups that become accepted in the United States, they have to somehow abide by the kind of American way to show that, you know, democracy will always triumph, that the U.S. is always on the road to progress, that it's racial, it's always getting better. If you question these kinds of things, you become kind of the, you know, you're frowned upon, right? You're not doing your job. You're not being the good minority, right? And I think these become, I see, as a kind of the lasting imprint that I want this book to kind of get people to think about, right? To think about what are the terms and stipulations that we put upon different groups, and also the kind of, and how these kinds of stipulations have international significance.
Yeah, the book is really, really interesting. I think it has, it can be read by historians, by political scientists, by a number of different groups. There's a lot of very good stuff. There's a lot of very good photographs from the time period as well. I enjoyed that. We often, I think, in our academic books don't put enough time into these. And I think it really does add to this very interesting story that Cindy tells in Citizens of Asian America, Democracy and Race During the Cold War, published by NYU Press. Cindy, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you so much, Heath.